Zealand Vegan Podcast, episode 119. I'm your host, Elizabeth Collins, and there's really lots to talk about today for myself to get off my chest. It's going to be quite a long episode. Anyway, I need to do it. It's quite a difficult one. I originally was going to just talk about a couple of things that were just really mostly about me, but about my experiences in terms of my own sort of personal development and self-awareness and things like that, painful realizations. But there's actually other things that have come up in the meantime that I'm going to sort of talk about as well. But what I really wanted to, I've been wanting to do this for a while, and it's hard to know where to begin, but it's mostly about, self-realization is really, really difficult in terms of, I've talked about before about recognizing your own speciesism and, you know, the manifestations of that, being aware of them, remembering that you were once non-vegan and therefore highly, highly speciesist. And I also think we as individuals need to take a look at our own race and privilege that goes along with that, as well as our own sex and privilege that goes along with that. And if you live in I think we all live in classed societies, really, some more overtly than others. Also, just any kind of privilege that you have. And I'm going to talk about sort of the things that I've learned about racism in my own, from my own point of view. I've had some really harsh self-realizations, and I'm really grateful to all the people in my life who've helped me along with that. I think I recognize a lot of my own defense mechanisms kicked in really quickly, and it was quite a painful discovery about myself. It's happened before. Basically, when I got into abolitionist veganism and I started to read Gary Francione's work about the nature of oppression being all interconnected with speciesism and how it's no different, that resonated with me, and I was like, yeah, you know, this is very true. I completely reject all of the ethnocentric and xenophobic and racist campaigning that a lot of single issue campaigning is in the mainstream animal movement. And I still have a lot to learn about it. And through my life, people have helped me. And the only way that I could really get any self-realization about racism and my part in it is through people who weren't white in my life, because for example, a long time ago now, before I was vegan, but I thought myself very progressive, and I guess I thought myself that way. I mean, I didn't really know these kind of terminology or anything like that. I was just going through life, and I was, I had thought that I'd experienced reverse racism, okay, because what happened is I ended up in the Dominican Republic, and I was, unlike most of the other tourists there, I guess I was a tourist, but I didn't go there to be a tourist. I was living there, and I was living with a family, my partner's at the time's family, and I was, as usual, I just didn't have a lot of money. Now, I certainly wasn't poor. I was able to eat, and I could catch the carro públicos, which cost two pesos. I mean, there was times where when I left his home, I was struggling, and I was only literally eating, I literally ate a banana a day and a little packet of galleticas, which is like this little packet of four crackers, or sometimes you could buy like a packet of six. So I was really not eating a lot, but I was smoking cigarettes. So I had money for cigarettes. Now, cigarettes over there are really cheap and they kill your appetite, but either way. But anyway, long story short. So I couldn't leave the house. I couldn't go anywhere without people thinking I was a sort of a tourist with money. And I really didn't have money to buy anything but food and pay for my transportation. That's what I was doing there. I couldn't go shopping or like buy, you know, tourist stuff. Like they have all these amazing art and all this stuff that they sell to tourists, but I couldn't leave the house without everything. Rubia, rubia, ven acá, ven acá. Rubia means blondie. And it's not meant to be an insult. It's just a descriptor. Just, you know, they're just very descriptive people over there. If you're a really, really skinny person, they call you flaca, but it's not an insult. It's just a descriptor. Anyway, so I felt really oppressed. Okay, you're going to laugh at me, but this is the kind of... So I felt really oppressed because I couldn't go anywhere without people screaming at me because I couldn't blend because I was completely... looked completely different from the general population. And the general population of the country was used to people who looked like me being tourists who were there to exploit, you know, the economy or have a nice fancy holiday in a resort or whatever. I remember one time we were I was with my boyfriend and some of his friends, and we had gone to this part of the beach that apparently the locals were not allowed on. It was now private land. This beach had been bought by a resort. And so they used me as a way of getting onto this beach, which I didn't speak any Spanish at the time. Like when I went there, I spoke no Spanish at all. So half the time for the first few months, I was only there for 1 year. I was only in the Dominican Republic for a year. And I didn't speak a lot of Spanish when I left. I learned most of my Spanish out of the country in New York when I was living with my Dominican family in New York. But so I didn't really know what was going on. And half the time they didn't bother to tell me. My boyfriend did not respect me at all. He was not a nice person, but so we were sitting on this beach and they're all talking amongst themselves, knowing what's going to happen. And I'm kind of like, what's going on? Like I was most of the time, what's happening? And, I mean, they all spoke English, but they only sort of filled me in on stuff when it was absolutely necessary. And the two guards come over with their, and they all carry rifles. The police there carry rifles and all the guards just walking around carry rifles slung over their shoulder. And my boyfriend, who could speak a little bit of English, who could speak English actually, I figured out, I guess later or maybe after a long time, that we weren't supposed to be on that beach because it was a tour. It was only for the people who were staying at the resort. So they made out that they were friends of mine, and I lived at the resort. I was at the resort. And they were just visiting me, so they were allowed to come as my guest, and that's why we were allowed to be on that part of the beach. And my boyfriend was putting on this really silly accent in English, pretending that he was an American who didn't speak Spanish. And I'm just sitting there going, I've not got a clue what's going on. But anyway, there was a lesson to me that this beach, like, that doesn't happen in New Zealand. I mean, there are not beaches here where you can't go and sit. We were just sitting there. We just were sitting there, and they were going to tell us to leave because the land had been bought from the, I guess, whoever, government or whatever, and the people who'd lived there for generations and who went on that beach couldn't go on that beach anymore. The only way that Dominicans could go into that resort were if they worked for the place. So, or I guess if they were guests, or if they were rich enough, I guess, to pay for a place at the resort. So anyway, you know, it was fine. I mean, apparently it worked. And I'm kind of glad in a way that I could use what I now recognize as white privilege. I could use my white privilege that I have been born with for my friends to be able to go to this really nice beach that was generally forbidden to them. So that was a long time ago, and, you know, only now do I start to sort of see these things for what they are. So anyway, and then I went to New York City, and I was still very, very ignorant. I mean, I've only just very recently, I think, really started to really realize and understand deeply about racism in this world and my role, my place, what I can do, what I must do, and, you know, come up to some really painful truths about it. with help from other people. I did not just, like, I've none of this, I wish I could say that I am just one of those people who just wakes up and realizes this stuff. I don't. I do not. I did not wake up and realize about veganism. I did not wake up and realize about abolition. I did not wake up and realize. I thought I knew about racism and sexism, but I really, really didn't. I was very indoctrinated, and it was people who had the guts to deal with my defensiveness and, you know, and my ignorance who have really, really helped educate me over the years. And it's only now that I feel like, and I've read a couple of articles that I'm going to share with you, but. So when I was in New York again, I went there right from the Dominican Republic, and I really just didn't have any money. But I was a citizen, and I'm white, so it was easy for me. I walked into a few restaurants, I just kept going into a restaurant saying, do you need a waitress? Because I knew how to be a waitress or a bartender, mostly a waitress, because bartending in New York is like a real, you know, it's an art form in a way, but... I had done a bartending course in New Zealand, but anyway, I got a job. I just walked in off the street and I got a job at this one place, and I was at the hostel and they let me stay there for free. All I had to do was man the front desk for my shift every morning. I was the first 4-hour shift, so for 4 hours a day manning the front desk, you know, answering the phone, checking people in, checking people out, I was able to live at this hostel for free. Now, at the time, I thought I was just struggling and I was just so poor and, I mean, da da da. But I, you know, now that I'm sort of realizing these things, I mean, that there are people who that option would never have been open to them just because of the color of their skin. They were perfectly, you know, as struggling or as sort of in need as I was at the time. I mean, I did not have any money. I would have been on the street if I hadn't been given a place in this hostel. But I didn't end up on the street because, you know, I'm part of this white establishment, and I don't want to make generalizations, but I'm just trying to let you know, like, these are the things I'm sort of realizing. So, and only now am I realizing it. I think that maybe, you know, it depends. Maybe somebody who wasn't white could have gone to this hostel and said, hey, I really need a place to stay. I mean, I was a Kiwi and the hostel was run by Australians. So that was one thing in my favor. And the manager of the hostel, not the owners, but the manager who I was working for, he was of Indian descent. He was Australian of Indian descent, but he was Australian. And so I managed to, and they let me stay there, and I had a bed. They didn't give me food. They didn't pay me money, but I had a roof over my head, at least, and a bed. I had a bed and a roof, you know? And I remember, but I ended up living in New York, and I got, you know, I went to school, and I got loans, and I got into City College, which is a great school. I love City College. But I remember, and so then I was really, City College is in Harlem. And it's on 137th to 142nd Street. That's like the address on Convent Avenue, which is close to 145th between Amsterdam and Broadway. So I ended up getting an apartment, a room in a brownstone. It was like one room, it was big, and the bathroom was down the hall. And I shared my bathroom with this lovely, lovely African-American older man. He was like a granddad, named Mr. Mickle. I love Mr. Mickle. May he rest in peace. He died after I moved out. I found out later that he died. But he was lovely. He was my neighbor. He was such a wonderful, wonderful man. And he really was too old to be living in that brownstone. It had no elevator, and the bathroom was down the hall, and there was no shower. You had to get into this big tub, and if you wanted to shower, you had to like run the water and pour it over yourself if you wanted to wash your hair and things. And he was elderly and he was not well, but he couldn't get into a state housing program. He was not a rich man. He was retired, but he was very poor. And he was living in this brownstone, and he was on the waiting list for public housing. And I remember I was working part-time because I was going to school, and I was getting, I think it was $8 an hour. And I was working 20 hours a week, $8 an hour before tax. So I can't remember how much it is, but not a lot of money. Like 22 times 8 is 160. So 20 times 8 is 160 minus tax. Okay, that's how much I was earning a week. And the brownstone, so I was at City College, and I was the man who ran the radio station. City College is a wonderful college. It's a university. It's part of City University of New York. It was the first one, actually. It used to be free university back in the days when books were free and education was free. And Joe Brown, may he rest in peace, he's also passed away, is a lovely, lovely member of the community, the African-American community. And he ran the City College radio station where I was working because I was into audio. I went and studied sound engineering there. And in fact, Joe Brown's the one who saved me because I didn't know there was a sound engineering program and I was dying to get out of City College and out of Harlem. And I wanted to go down to the East Side and study at one of the other colleges. I can't remember the one that was, because I was going to do fine arts. I was going to do visual arts. I was really into visual arts. But I still love music and I went to the radio station and he's like, you really want to study music, you should go to the sound engineering course. So I ended up staying in Harlem at City College. So I needed a place to live where I didn't, because I was traveling from Queens, which is very far on the subway. I had to, you know, get up and catch two subways to get to City College. And then I went to work and then I went home. So it was like a 12-hour day, which is nothing. Most people have 12-hour days. But I mean, a lot of people have 12-hour days. But anyway, I wanted to live close to school so I didn't have to commute all the way to school and then all the way to work and then all the way home and do that every day. So he told me, Joe Brown, lovely man, he knew my situation and he told me that he knew about a room in the Brownstone. It was very cheap. It was $63 a week. That's literally how much it was. Very, very cheap for New York. This is in 1998. So I was very excited and he said to me, go and see Mrs. And I can't remember her name and tell her Joe Brown sent you. I've told her about you and you go there and you tell her that you're interested in this room because I know she's got a room available. And it was just down on 144th and Convent. So it's literally like a 5-minute walk from school, which would have been perfect because I had some classes where I'd have like a class and then I'd have a 2-hour break and then I'd have another class. And then for those 2 hours, I just had to just hang around. I didn't have anywhere to go, but now I could go home and have a sleep, you know, have a nap. If I got this room and it would save me money because it doesn't save you money. That's right. Cause in New York I just paid a monthly pass for the subway. It's much cheaper than traveling than in New Zealand. But anyway, it saved me time and it would be nice to live close. So I went to see her and she saw me and then, she wanted to raise the price. She offered me for $70 a week. Now that to me was a massive difference. I mean, when you're only earning, you know, $130 or whatever it is, and then they try to raise your rent by $7, I mean, that's quite a big chunk. I was thinking, gosh, I really don't know if I could pay 70. And I went back to Joe and I said, Joe, she's offering me 70. And he said, oh, no, I'll talk to her. And then he must have told her, said, look, she is not a wealthy girl. Like, I guess a lot of people who go there and go to City College who are not from New York. I was not from New York. I was living there now, but, you know, I wasn't really from there. A lot of them, they are from overseas and they have quite wealthy family members who pay for them to stay in apartments. I mean, there were some people going to my school who were parents, they were living in Soho and their parents were from Japan and they were paying these big fancy apartments, but I was certainly not in that position. I didn't even have really any contact with my parents. So I was just like, Joe, this woman is trying to charge me more. So he talked to her and she ended up charging me 63 and I stayed there. And I always just thought, oh, it's because I'm white, she thinks I'm rich. And I resented it, you know, but this, like I say, these are those realizations I'm having now. I mean, obviously she didn't think I was rich because I mean, $70 a week is still really, really cheap and it was not a fancy place. It was perfect. But anyway, that's another story. And then another story I'll tell you about going along where I still thought that I was like being, you know, like I was like dealing with reverse racism, whatever. And I'm going to, this just doesn't exist because racism is structural, but I just didn't know these things. So I was living in Harlem and this was in 98 and it was before, so I was living in 144th, like 145th and Broadway is kind of like 145th is at that time, I'm sure it's changed now because it's definitely changed now, but it was, you know, I just never really went up to Broadway except for when I went to the supermarket during the day because it was quite rough there. There's a lot of drug dealing at night on Broadway. Amsterdam was okay. It was less, it was just a little more suburban, but up on 145th and Broadway, it was kind of scary. I wouldn't really go up there after dark. It was scary. And also because I was white and I was in Harlem, and at this time, Harlem, at that in that part of Harlem, it was really black people and Latin people. Dominicans have a lot of African blood in them, so they're black. A lot of Dominicans are black, although there's a lot of Spanish blood and mixed blood with Indian, but like native, indigenous people. But anyway, so again, I would step out of my other house, and I was just instantly stand out, and people would, and at first, and like I was used to it after being in the Dominican Republic. Where I could, I just couldn't leave the house without having all this attention on me. And I don't like being a center of attention. I don't like it. And it makes me very, very nervous. And but I and I was just always just hated it. So then in Harlem, that but they were but the people in there, I went to City College, and there was a couple of foreign students in the neighborhood. Not that many. There was a couple, but I really stood out. And at that time, and then they used to be like, hey, Snowflake, and that apparently was not meant to be a threat or an insult. It was a flirt, I guess. And people would, just the guys. I was young, and the males would say, hey, Snowflake, and all this stuff. And I just was like, whatever. My so I was living there for a while. I lived there for about 3 years, and I went to school the whole time. And I had a boyfriend. His name was Rico, and he was black, African American. And sometime when after Giuliani was really getting going and things, the neighborhood started to become this neighborhood, which was happening all over the city and all over the world, was starting to call what they call gentrified. I don't like that term. I think it's a rude term, like gentrified. Like this is the gentry coming in, and then the people who live there aren't. Aren't civilized or whatever, but anyway, that's the name for it. And basically what happens is that it's usually black neighborhoods, and then non-blacks will they won't be able to afford the super expensive places, like the ridiculously expensive places where all of the rich people live, who are mostly white. So like downtown, so they were moving up and up and up. So then what happens, but they had still had more money. They were still more privileged. They had white privilege, so they had more money, and they had the means to pay higher rent. So they'd come up to neighborhoods, and this was just and it just started to happen. And when this neighborhood where I had been living, all of a sudden there's people moving up there, and they were paying really high rents compared to. So the landlords are just like, well, I'm going to make money. So you have a, you know how you have some people, they move into a building, the families who've been living there for 2 or 3 or 4 generations paying a certain amount of rent, they get kicked out because the people moving in, and they're white people moving in, can pay more rent, and so the landlords rent to those people, and then the black people are unable to afford to live in this neighborhood anymore. That was what was starting to happen. Now I was still living in my little brownstone room, and it would gone up. She put it up like 1% a year. She's a very fair landlady, and I was still not earning a lot of money. I was a student. I was a full-time student, and I just had to keep quitting jobs because I did the music classes, and they were really at a certain time of year, and sorry, a certain time of the day, and so I had to like quit a few jobs. And I ended up just working weekends because that was the only time I didn't have class, but I still was not earning a lot of money. But I was able to live there. Was not poor. I had money for my rent, I had money for food, I had money for transport, and I had a credit card, which is a big mistake. But anyway. But I mean, I didn't consider myself part of this phenomenon. Like I was like, well, I'm not one of those people that's doing this. I'm not doing that. I've just lived here because, it was close to my school, and I couldn't afford to live in any other place. And so what happened is it started to happen in my neighborhood, and it started to really happen and really affect the people in my neighborhood. And this was in a very short amount of time. Okay. Like I can't even imagine what 144th looks like now. I can't even imagine. 125th was already changing. But I don't know. Maybe it's the same. I really don't know, but I just don't know. But so what started to happen, here I'm finally getting to my point, is when I was walking around the neighborhood again, instead of like all of this kind of sort of half, friendly, they'd be like, "What are you doing here? What little white girl," or whatever. Like in the beginning, it's a lot of sort of flirting, but and sort of good-natured kind of. I guess they just figured that I was there because I was, either going to City College and I wasn't one of the really wealthy foreign students, or I don't know, that changed. And there was a lot of anger in the air, and I was just there, but I was now, it wasn't so friendly. There wasn't a lot of friendliness. I was another one of those white people who were moving into the way that it was seen. I was part of this gentrification, and I got very upset about that. And I remember I was with, so here's my story. This is the leading up to the story. So I went down to the takeaways, the fast food place where I all used to go and get a lot of takeout Chinese, like I say, way before I'm vegan. And I walk in, and there was an older black man in there, and he was talking about what was happening, I guess. And then he saw me and he started to raise his voice, and he was talking really loudly about the white devil. And he said a bunch of other stuff, but I think he was talking about inequality. But of course, at the time, I was just feeling very victimized. And I was a little bit scared. Not really. I mean, he wasn't threatening me. He was just very angry. And he was talking about, he was making sure that I could hear. And, you know, of course, I thought this was a really big deal. So I lost my appetite and I went back to my, I got my food though, and I went back to my apartment and I rang Rico and I was crying. And I was just crying and crying. Like, oh, this is, and, you know, thinking I was a victim, you know, of racism. And I remember Rico, who was probably one of the best things that ever happened to me. He was just really, really taught me a lot about myself. I mean, like I say, this is way back when I was just starting to learn about these things, but it's taken me a really long time to get where I am now, where I can actually take a look at myself and realize, you know what I mean? This is how long it takes for the sort of denial of people to break down. And I can only talk about my own experience. There might be people listening to this who don't understand or just think I'm, you know, whatever. I'm just trying to share this things that happen because it's related to our advocacy and it's related to everything that we do in our lives, you know? And the defense mechanisms are very similar to the defense mechanisms of non-vegans, I've discovered to my own, you know, sort of chagrin about myself. So I was like, Rico, this guy, he was talking about, you know, the white devil, and I lost my appetite. I'm just not even hungry. I was so hungry, and now I just don't even want to eat. And Rico was like, he was a really, really intelligent guy. He was supposed to be a doctor. He dropped out of medical school. He had a rough, I mean, he was black in America, you know. His story was said he was from Cleveland, which is a very segregated city, but I think his dad had a hairdresser in Harlem. And, you know, Rico he'd lost an eye, had been shot out when he was 5 with a BB gun, something like that. So he, you know, that kind of messed up his life. And then so anyway, Rico's another story. He was actually homeless when I met him, but I didn't know that. Because, you know, you people can be homeless and you just don't know it. Have you ever known that? There are actually people walking around. You might not even know that they're homeless, and they might be. But anyway, he was like, at first I thought he was being empathetic with me, but he was being cheeky in a way, but he was genuine. So he's like, oh, you lost your appetite? And I was like, yeah. And he was like, oh, did it make you not hungry anymore? And I was like, mm-hmm. And then he's like, oh. And he's like, well, basically what he said to me was, well, you might have lost your appetite, but you don't know what it's like to lose a job opportunity or to not get into a place in university or to not be able to go into a store or a restaurant because of what color you are. So he's like, I'm really sorry that you lost your appetite, but you should try what it's like when you lose a heck of a lot more than your appetite. I can't remember exactly how he put it, but he basically said that. And I was just so like, because he was not empathetic at all. He wasn't being cruel. He was just trying to snap me and just wake me up and just, you know, in his own way was saying to me, you know, what happened to you was, you know, not nice or anything like that, but he was, you know, as a black man who, and I was all complaining about this guy, this man, this gentleman in the takeout store getting angry about inequality, and Rico was letting me know he was right about inequality. You might not like it, but that man had a point. And you know, he was using words like white devil and things like that, which, you know, as we know, like, if you want to, I believe in not using name calling and stuff in advocacy, but this was not this man wasn't trying to advocate me. He was talking to other people, but he wanted me to hear it. So Rico just, I felt like a slap in the face. And I was so hurt, like, oh my God, he's so mean. I couldn't believe how, like, how cold-hearted Rico was being. But it woke me up. And I never forgot what he said. And I realized it because he said to me, have you ever lost, have you ever been denied a job? Interview because of what color you are. And I had to say, well, no, I mean, and I know that I hadn't, I just hadn't. So he asked me all those questions, and then that was the end of the conversation. And he was just like, you know, in other words, stop whining, eat your lunch, you've got it pretty good, kind of thing. And it might sound, you know, really cruel to some people, but Rico was really, he was not a mean person. He was very intelligent and a very intelligent person. And he knew the reality because he lived it every day. So that was, that was one of my experiences. And I've never forgotten it. And I've told people that story before because when I was starting to wake up a little bit to the reality, because I grew up in a completely, you know, white suburban neighborhood, very, very privileged. You know, I just... Honestly, it's just really amazing how ignorant you can be about the reality of other people's lives. And the same thing goes with sexism. That happened, you know, a long time ago, but I never forgot what he said, and it did snap me out of it a little bit. And I never forgot that lesson that Rico taught me. But I didn't really understand it at the time. I was more hurt and feeling sorry for myself still than anything else. I really was. I mean, I was really focused on that. I thought he didn't understand, and he was just, you know, but he had a point. I couldn't deny the truth of what he was saying. And I got the message, as painful as it was. You know, when I get into abolition, and I'm learning, you know, this rhetoric, and it's almost the same. So, like, for example, I just really feel like I'm still learning how to really understand and articulate the sort of the root problems, like the realities of what racism is and what it really means for people. I could talk the talk, and I knew it sounded intuitively right. And this is the same with, I'm going to talk a little bit more about my realism about patriarchy as well, because that's another thing that I'm still learning. Like, I'm really comfortable articulating, interpreting as best I can on a one-to-one basis if I have to in the street, the abolitionist approach when it comes to animal rights. And I can easily link it to human rights, you know, because it is all related. But I didn't really, the bottom line is, I don't know what racism feels like. I have never experienced racism because I'm white, and I've only ever benefited from racism, ever. And that is something that I've only just now been forced to face, because I always thought that I was this champion, and I was always like living amongst black people, so I was like, yeah, I know, you know, I wasn't one of those, you know, a part of the oppressive, you know, regime. It's funny though, because like remember how I talked about this thing in the beach in the Dominican Republic? When I was going out with Rico, when I was, you know, he had one eye, his left eye was missing. And he used to wear sunglasses to hide it, but and it just looked like it was closed, it just looked like he'd been punched in the eye. Sometimes you couldn't really tell what was wrong, but after a while you realized that he didn't have an eye on his left side, and that obviously, because of given on top of all the other prejudice about black men, and his eye was shot out when he was 5 years old by a BB gun at point blank range by, I think, an older cousin or something. It wasn't a gang thing. Nobody really knows why this happened. And I'm really sorry. I mean, this is private. I shouldn't be talking. I mean, I don't think Rico's ever going to ever listen to this podcast, but I just can imagine that, you know, he, on top of all the other, and he was really big. He was like 6'3" and about 300 pounds. He was a massive, you know, I'm sure that he was targeted, let me just put it that way, by police and whatnot. But I often had little dreams, like, cause, and I was going to City College, which is in Harlem, and there's a lot of City College. I loved it. It was very mixed, very mixed. It wasn't homogenous. I don't like homogeny. And I was going to Adrico, and I sometimes fantasized about using the way I looked as this, like, very white, you know, blonde woman who could blend into the white establishment. And I used to have, this is so weird that I'm telling you this, I just can't believe it, but I did have these little fantasies of, like, infiltrating, you know, because I could pass off, like, if I had the right clothes and things like that, and if I remembered not to swear, because boy did I, I had the filthy mouth, I could probably quite easily blend into, you know, this sort of rich white society easily. And I had little fantasies about, I don't know, somehow, just, it's hard to explain, and I don't, they're kind of really ethereal and not tangible, but I did have little fantasies about being like the infiltrator, you know, and using my position once I got in there to help, you know, other people, non-white people. I didn't really have anything concrete. It was more like a silly, but I did think about that. But I just only now, so these are these, yeah, so I knew, like, I could speak about, and, like, I would see Gary Francione talking on his Facebook page, they would be talking about male privilege, white male privilege, and he openly admit, he'd say, look, I benefit from this, I completely benefit as a white male from the oppression of black people and the oppression of women, and he would say that, and I thought, okay, and so, like I say, I was learning to see it, but I was only, because of when I first started on the abolitionist movement, it was, it's the people that I was first dealing with as abolitionists, they were all white as well, so we were talking this talk, but we weren't experiencing racism. It wasn't until non-white people really started to get involved in the abolitionist movement, and I have had the privilege of having some really intense conversations. I'm not going to mention any names because I don't know if they'd want me to, but that was when it finally hit me that I was, oh my God, I've benefited from racism. And you know, so going back, so this has been a sort of a long realization, but it's my defense mechanism. I mean, we had some intense conversations. I've had some intense conversations with people, and man, my defense mechanisms, talk about going into 150 miles and, like, so much, like, it was really painful for me to realize just how defensive I was and how much in denial I was and how much I didn't want to face, you know, the fact that that was real, and how I needed to just, what I really, I know I'm doing a whole podcast talking about myself, but this is my podcast, and it's about me, and I do hope it helps other people, but what I really need to do is, as a white person, is to shut up and listen, because I don't experience racism, and there's an article that's called, I've posted a link to it, it's called Why Reverse Racism Isn't Real, and it's on feminspire.com, which I imagine is a feminist website. I don't know. I've only ever seen this article. But I'll share the article because, again, I'm still learning. Like, I'm so new to actually being able to really understand what the actual and the structural implications of what it really, really means, because I've never experienced it. So, for example, when I was in the takeout shop that time, and that individual man was sort of talking, was name calling, for example, that's basically what he was doing. Reverse racism, and this article explains it better than me, so here we go, if you were, you know, I think the author of this article is white, I'm not sure, But it's a very well-written article, and so she just said to said, listen, she says, when I'm online talking to people and a person of color is sharing their experience with racism, I'm listening and I'm learning. This is the author of the article. This is an experience I will probably never have in my lifetime simply because of the skin I was born into. I need to know what I can do to be a better ally and to make the world a more equal place, one interaction at a time. So then inevitably, she says, so I observe, I listen, I try to understand. And then she says, inevitably, here comes a white person either claiming they've had a similar experience because they grew up in an all-black neighborhood and got chased on the way home from school, or because their friend tried to touch their straight hair without permission. I mean, she talks about how people have, you know, experienced these things. She said, listen, if things happen to you, you know, like individual things happen to you, you know, that was wrong, and I'm sorry that happened to you, but that's not actually racism, because the situations, she says, in which you, a fellow white person, were involved were unfortunate and inappropriate. This is true, but to claim that these experiences were reverse racism as such both diminishes and minimalizes the real and actual experiences of people of color who do encounter racism. There's no system of oppression. This is an American article that there's no system of oppression in America that actively works to oppress and subjugate white people. Sorry to break it to you, but your individual suffering is just that individual. And she's not belittling that incident, but what she's saying is, when she talks about how there's no reverse racism, this is what she's talking about. So read the article, okay? Read the article. Please read the article. And next time you are, and if you're a white person listening, next time, please can we try to listen more? Because I was like, this whole time I've been having these conversations with people, I'm so quick to share my, oh, well, this happened to me and this happened to me. And I like, I'm trying to empathize and like show, yeah, no, I understand, because I've been there, you know, and it's not. And I really don't know what it's like. And I really don't know what it's like. I've only ever benefited. And it sickens me that I have. I don't think it's right. I'm not saying that I'm not lucky that I haven't been oppressed, and you know, I'm just, nobody should be oppressed. I'm not saying that it should be reversed and that the tables should turn and white people should be oppressed. I don't think revenge is the way to go, but I certainly don't like the fact. I mean, I could have done with less, and so that other people could have more. One of the lines that really struck me out of the book, this book written by Kate Millett, called, crikey, I can't even remember the name of the book now. It's like one of the most, hold on just a minute, Kate Millett, books. Sorry, this is terrible of me. Sexual Politics, okay, was the line that says, the haves, you know how we have like the phrase the haves and the have-nots? I'm pretty sure it was out of Sexual Politics, but might have been out of another feminist book. The haves forget that they have so much because, directly because, others have so little. Now, I'm paraphrasing, but that was what she said. And that struck me so much. That is so true. And so about, so I, now I'm going to talk about my job as well, because this has been going on in my job as well. Because, so all of this kind of stuff has been culminating recently to this, me wanting to talk about in this podcast, because I mean, I really hope, I can only hope that I know I finally had this realization, which I mouthed the mouth and I talked the talk. I did. I talked the talk. I reflected the rhetoric. Oh, yes, I know I'm a white person and I have white privilege, but I really didn't believe it. I really didn't face it. I really didn't understand how actually true it was. I really did genuinely think that I'd been a victim of racism, in terms of, rather than this individual action. Like, read that article if you want to understand. And like, it's, words are so tricky, but just please, can we understand the concept here? Let's look at racism as a structural concept, a very real thing that happens to people. And then we can stop trying to be pedantic about it, okay? Because yes, there's violence against people because of their skin color, and there are white people who are murdered by black people in individual situations. But there's, and that's a murder, and that's an individual murdering another individual. And, you know, maybe they can say it was racially motivated or whatever in that instant, but that's not what we're talking about. Is this structural oppression that we all need to face up to, and we're never going to be able to change it. Like, I still feel helpless against, I don't, all I know is I do want to be an ally. I want to be an ally. I want to, now that I recognize I have this white privilege, right? like I did back when I had those sort of vague fantasies. I really seriously want to be an ally. And part of that is going to have to be shutting up for once and listening, really listening to what it's like, and not trying to make it about myself and not trying to throw, you know, just shutting up and listening. But I want to be that ally. So, for example, so now I'll talk a little, I don't talk about my job, but just know that I work in New Zealand, and there is definite racism here. The Maori people, if you want to know the history of New Zealand, read about it. There's definitely oppression, and there is racism, and the people who are suffering it are the Maori primarily, but also Pacific Island. There is a huge intolerance and hatred and ethnocentrism against Chinese people. New Zealand has a big Chinese population that has, ever since Hong Kong was going to go back to China, the Hong Kong Chinese did not want to become part of communist China, and so they started to look for other places to live. And we had a lot of immigration to New Zealand. And, you know, the racism against Chinese people is not limited, as everybody's racist against them. And they just call them all, like, nobody differentiates. It's very, racism against Asian people racism is pervasive, but racism against Asian people is pervasive to the point that, like, for example, you know, there's black people are racist against Asian people, Pacific Island people, Maori people are racist against Asian people here. It's really, really severe. So in other words, it doesn't matter if you're Chinese, Japanese, Korean, it's really strong here. Really it is. Because, like, I was at work the other day, and one of my colleagues, I'll give you an example, and this is after all this kind of really intense sort of stuff's been happening, and so she is Cook Island Māori and Tongan, I believe. So she's Pacific Island, you know, ethnicity, if you want to call it, New Zealander, and her boyfriend is from Wales, and she was just telling me about something that happened to her boyfriend from a supervisor. And I knew that apparently there's been problems with the supervisor who was behaving inappropriately or whatever. And then at this point she said to me, and I finally realized, and then she said to me, well, you know, he's Chinese, so. And I just said, stop right there. And I just changed the subject. I just said, because I did not want to hear that. It's like, don't tell me what race he is. I don't care what race he is. In this situation, or like, I guess it's not true, because we have to recognize that race does matter. Like, a lot of people who, like, you know, people who are rich, they never talk about money because they have it. So, like, a lot of people can say race doesn't matter, but that's usually white people who don't deal with racism. But in this instance, what I'm trying to say is, like, she was explaining this person's behavior, and then she was sort of qualifying it with, like, well, he's Asian. Oh, that's right. She didn't even say Chinese. She said Asian. So she doesn't even know. Like, is he Chinese, Korean? I mean, these are different peoples, different countries, different languages, you know? It was a big deal for her to say that, to point out she's Asian. Like, we would have, now I would understand. Like, we would have this little understanding, you know? Because she said, oh, anyway. But a while ago at work, we were talking about, because what we're trying to do is, There needs to be more recognition of Māori tanga, or te reo Māori, which is the language, and tikanga Māori, the culture. And I'm still learning. I'm going to go take a te reo course now. I really want to learn some Māori words now. I really want to actually really genuinely want to be an ally and show respect and try to do something. But there's been some talks, and there's some heavy discussions, because there was like a workshop that we all did, and we all got into groups. And interestingly, they segregated us by race in this group, because they wanted the Māori to have their own table so they could talk safely amongst themselves. This was the employees about what it was like. They could feel safe, almost like women trying to have safe discussions about sexism, wanting to just have a discussion with other women about it in that moment. So I thought it was And this was like a year or two ago that this happened, maybe a year ago or more. And I was in another group, and we were trying to discuss what it was like. And I can't even remember. This is embarrassing. I can't even remember exactly the whole nature of this workshop. But in my group, there was a little bit of heat because we were. So I think it was one of two of us brought up the fact that, we've really benefited. Like, we really benefit in this society. We're the lucky ones. We're the white ones in New Zealand. We benefit. And one of the women took exception to that. And she's like, well, I don't feel guilty about being white. I don't feel any guilt. And I still, like I said, I'm still learning this sort of rhetoric, and to be able to, because I really want to be an informed person to be able to discuss and express things. And also, I need to listen more, right? Like I said. But so I said, well, I do. And then there's another one at my table says, yeah, well, I do. And that was the wrong thing to say. For one thing, there's this thing called white guilt, and a lot of white people use it as an excuse to rubbish any white person being conscientious or trying to become aware of privilege that they have. And they say, oh, you just got white guilt. Well, for one thing, guilt is a useless possession. My father told me that once. I've never forgotten it. Guilt is a useless possession. It does nobody any good. What you want is awareness. So now that I've learned and I've had some more conversations and I've read some amazing written, expressions of these concepts, and I'm just starting to sort of realize these things and wake up to them. I wish that I could be back at that table and I could turn to them and say, listen, to the woman who's like, well, I don't feel guilty. I wish that I could say to her, well, it's not about feeling guilty. It's about acknowledging the truth that you have benefited, that we've all benefited from the oppression of these people. It doesn't mean that we were deliberately wanted to perpetrate it necessarily, but we have to recognize that we've benefited from it. That is an awareness, and then we can move forward and maybe, things can change. But until we have that awareness, nothing's going to change because you're just in denial and you're just focused on yourself. And so I don't like the conversation. I like, oh, white guilt. I don't feel guilty. And I said, well, I do. But what I didn't really, I mean, I do feel guilty. I don't like the history, I don't like actually being a member of the oppressors. However, like I say, I want to now finally that I have this awareness and there's nothing I can do about it. It's the truth. I've only benefited from racism ever. And I want to be an ally. And I need to listen. First of all, I have a lot more to learn. So then, not long ago, we had just a little while ago, a couple of, like last week, I think, we had some of the Māori advisors come and do a presentation to my. I'm still on this secondment at this other department, which I love, but I'm very sad because I have to go back to my other to the other place I was working next month, and that's. I'm just going to be a real downer. I don't want to go back, but I have no choice. But anyway, it's been a wonderful experience and it's been much more relaxing and my life has completely changed. And it's been great, but anyway, I have to go back to the other place because the secondment's over. Just for people who aren't in New Zealand, a secondment is like a temporary placement because somebody might go and leave and have a baby and you get to fill their position for a while, but then when they come back, you have to go back to your other position. So I have to go back to my other department. But anyway, they came and talked to us, and I've now sort of read some of these articles, and I've woken up to this reality that first of all I've been in denial, and that I've had this terrible defense mechanism, and that I was, I reacted a lot, the way a lot of non-vegans react when they are told the truth that they're exploiting animals. I went into all these behaviors, and I have been doing so basically my whole life. So I said to her, so we were talking about, what are we going to do to make the voices of Māori more prominent and deal, be more just being aware, and also part of it, they really want us, the Māori population is like, learn our language, even just a little, because language is history, language is culture, language is the key to people's worlds, and just speak it a little bit, even just greetings or something like that. Make some effort is really what they're saying. Of course, they'd like a bit more than that. That might seem like paying lip service or whatever, but this is, they're saying, you know, at the very least, let's begin doing this, but there's a lot more that, you know, needs to be done. But acknowledgement of the fact that they've been totally screwed over, that they were totally screwed over by the Treaty of Waitangi. They were invaded, they were oppressed, you know, and then that generationally, just like all these other people, the Aboriginals in Australia and the Indigenous Americans and the Black Americans and just anybody who's oppressed, they suffer oppression, and then they fall into poverty, and then there's drug and alcohol abuse, and then there's child abuse and domestic violence, and there's more poverty, and then those children grow up and they become abusers and drug addicts. I mean, and it's not because these people are inherently this way. It's because of what happened to them. It's because of what was done to them, to their people, and then it becomes a cycle. And it can happen in any race and in any color. If you take people and they are oppressed and they're poor and they are surrounded by violence and then they grow up in violence, they just perpetuate it. It's a vicious circle. We know this. It just so happens that when it happens to a people who were oppressed by another group of people and who are more often than not non-white, those are the people who are suffering from it. I mean, family violence hits all areas of society, and patriarchy is the main reason. But in terms of poverty and lack of education and early pregnancies, not having access to birth control, a lot of that's religion as well. So basically there's major issues, and a first thing that needs to be acknowledged is that there are real reasons why this is happening. It is about oppression, and having the token like scholarship opportunity or whatever isn't going to actually do it. At the very beginning, first thing we need is to be realize and to have awareness and to admit. We have to admit that painful, painful truth that we have all benefited from racism. So I was set. So we did an exercise where we sat in a row, two rows of chairs facing each other. And you were directly opposite one other person in a line, and I was opposite one of my Māori colleagues, and they gave us the list of these principles, and some of it is very amazing. We ran out of time, but the second principle was whakapapa. Whakapapa is a Māori word which means, it basically means history, but it means more than history. It can mean, it's like a journey. It can mean, it's who you are, it's where you came from, it's where you're going. Right now you're I don't know how to say it right because I'm still learning, but you're sort of making your own whakapapa, your family has whakapapa. And I was talking to my colleague, and I was really keen to share my new self-realizations with her. And I was trying really hard to say, hey, you're looking at an ally. You are looking at an ally. And I was like, I said, have you ever heard of white privilege? And my colleague is looking at me like I'm some weirdo, like, hello, of course I've heard of it. It's affected my whole life. And of course, like rich people with money who never talk about money, I've never even thought about white privilege because it's just, you know what I mean? Like you just don't until you're forced to, and then you have to face up to it, and it's a good thing. So thank you to everybody who's helped me on this journey and who will still help me. So then I said, well, I realize now, finally, that I am benefited from racism. And I said, what I really want to do, my whakapapa is, I said, I have a whakapapa of I'm white. I grew up very privileged. I was very ignorant of my privilege. I was really unaware of the true implications of what racism does and what it does in our society. And I said, and what I really want to do is I really want to be an ally, and I really want to listen. And I said, and I think the most important thing that we can do for Māori is to listen. And that's what I really want to do. And that's what I said. And I hope that she thought it was genuine, and not, because you're suspicious. I'd be suspicious. I imagine that you're suspicious of people when you've been grown up in an oppressed group. I'm suspicious of men. So just a brief touch upon how this relates to, so that's my story, and I really hope that I can become a real ally, but I have a long way to go, and I still have a lot of resistance, and I still have a lot of I still have a lot of, what's the word? Denial. I'm still in denial and defenses, and I still talk. I want to talk and keep talking about my experiences. And that happens. So that's going to take a lot of learning, really a lot of learning. But I finally feel like I finally have awareness. It's taken however many years, but I at least awareness is only the beginning. Then you have a long journey to go to actually implement it and to actually undo as best you can the decades and decades of conditioning and racism and privilege that you've been indoctrinated with. Now, I'm not saying I want to martyr myself. I don't think martyrdom is a great idea. I don't want to martyr myself. That's not what this is about. I just finally realize a few things. That's all. So, yeah. To do with sexism, I did the same thing. I am still learning. That's why I say I'm a student of feminism. I still come not comfortable articulating what I really mean. I try to lean on those who are really fluent in the language, if you were. And I'm trying to read. I want to read more Andrea Dworkin, and I've read a couple of books, but I remember a while ago, like this is back when this see all of this stuff. I only really started to try to really, really relate it and be real about it as an advocate when I got into the abolitionist movement, because the abolitionist movement is about dealing with all of that. And then again, so a couple of years back when I, or it maybe a bit more, I was only really just learning, because I'm very oppressed by patriarchy. I am really, it's really terrible what patriarchy did. I'm not even going to talk about it, but I'm finally realizing, and I got very angry, very, very angry when I looked back on my life. I'm humiliated. But anyway, moving onwards. So I there was we would be talking to people, and we'd be talking about the sexist campaigns, and we would be talking about, the women who are, it's like the PETA campaigns where they have naked strippers and stuff for the animals. And I was and I could like and I knew intuitively it was right. So I'd see Gary Francione talking about it, and I knew it was right, and I would point people to that, and I'd say, but I couldn't. I just hadn't internalized it yet, because I didn't quite understand. And I remember I was somebody had said, they kept saying this thing, and I knew that they were right, and I was like, there was something truth in that, but I couldn't quite articulate it. So I would just copy and paste what they'd said. And what they were basically saying was, because a lot of women say, oh, well, these women are doing it voluntarily. They're not feeling oppressed. They're very happy to take off their clothes, and they get paid for it, and they're great. And they're talking about models and all these kinds of things as well. Not necessarily like. Not necessarily prostitutes who are making very little, money, and who are a lot of times victims of terrible, terrible abuse, the vast majority. But the models, because they'd get models who were very, very well paid, and they would do these PETA, I'd rather go naked than wear fur campaigns. And then this person would be like, yes, but you're not thinking about the effect that it has on women in other countries who are suffering. Now I understand it. Now I can finally articulate it. But he was basically saying that, this affects other women in other countries that aren't quite, that don't have the privileges that you have, because they're still in a very, very dangerous and oppressed situation. And when you are putting this sexist message out there that women are objects, it directly affects their lives in massive ways. Rape and the oppression of them because of this pervasiveness, it carries over. It's not in a bubble. You don't live in a bubble. So I knew, and he said it in a certain way, and I wish I still had the quote, and I can't. And I would quote it, but I just couldn't quite put it the same way. Like, I didn't really know. I knew what he intuitively was saying was right, but I didn't really understand. I was like, I didn't quite understand what he was talking about in terms of how the actions of the women in America and this publicity of the objectification of women could affect a woman in, another country. I just was ignorant about that. Now I understand it, and I'll post a couple of articles about. There was an article about what's called sex positive feminism, which I don't even think that term is accurate, and neither does the author, I don't think. There's a couple of articles I post, but that was another, this is just another example, you see, where I intuitively, and of course for me, you know, the racism thing is very difficult for me because I am part of the, I'm a member of the privileged, you know, of the privileged bunch, the bunch that the majority of whom is oppressing the others. So that's really hard to admit, especially when you want to be this fair, just person and you just can't stand the face of reality. It's just awful to realize that. You know, I've had good schools. And I did this all voluntarily, took off around the world with a backpack and no money. I did that to myself. I wasn't pushed into that. I could have stayed in my home and stayed in New Zealand and gotten, you know, and had all the privileges. And even when I was out there being a fool and putting myself in danger, I was still protected a lot of times by my white privilege. But as a woman, I can really relate to patriarchy. And so when it came to these discussions about the oppression of women, I was a lot more sure of myself because I could sort of share my experiences, even though I hadn't really realized them at the time. And like I say, I'm still learning about that, and I'm going through a lot of anger about that. But it was another example where I, you know, but the important thing is to be exposed to the rhetoric and to be exposed to the learning, and then you can, once you finally internalize it. But if your gut tells you it's right, but you just can't quite, you just don't, you sort of theoretic, like you. In you intuitively know it's right, but intellectually you still don't quite understand. You just know, and then you just keep at it, and eventually you'll figure it out. Like I did with this, because I just started reading. I read articles, you know. Reading is so important. I mean, I think, you know, if I could really, like, one of the careers that I really want, if you would say to me, what do you want to do for a career, I would love more than anything to teach adults who cannot read how to read, and young people. Like, I don't, like, I'm not talking about children who are going to learn to read or not. I'm talking about people who've never had the opportunity to learn how to read. I really, really want to teach people how to read who are illiterate. It's a dream. I mean, that for me would be a dream job, because I mean, that's why they were so against the black slaves learning how to read and write. In our human world, words are power. They are power. So, yeah. So, anyway, I don't know that I feel so much better having just talked about that and just sharing my little journey. And I've still got a long way to go, but it's been really great. And so, I'm really grateful to the people who have taught me so much. Anyway, there's more to be said, but that's all I'm going to say. It's, and I just want to be an ally, and I'm not saying I'm all powerful, but I at very least can be aware and admit the painful truths and be really, you know, the key to progress is awareness. That's the first step, and then you have to implement it, and then you have to learn really what that really means. So anyway, I don't know if I should talk about these other things. It's already been an hour. But I just, there's been some things happening in the movement, in the abolitionist movement, where there's some really, I'm going to talk about them because I'm just going to talk about them. So moving, putting all that, all of my personal journey aside, and I'm still on that, and thank you very much. But I want to just talk about these latest things. Like, I realize that my internet world and my animal activism world is really, really small. And that's fine. I'm actually really, like, I just want to cultivate this really definite environment of complete and utter no bollocks approach, and I welcome people into there who are willing to learn. I really don't go running around and reading and looking at other Facebook pages or groups or websites who are doing other things, because I just really want to just be a bastion or be part of a bastion of where people can come and they can be exposed to, and I just want to cultivate that. So I live in a really small world, and there's a lot going on out there that I don't know about. But what I'm trying to talk about is, so I'm an admin on Gary Francione's Facebook page, and recently there's been some discussion about what's called the Kaparos campaign. It's a campaign by a lot of the mainstream animal rights movements about let me just pull up some articles. I'm pretty sure it's a group called United Poultry Concerns. Okay, so here's what I want to say. So we get these groups. So we on the Abolitionist Approach Facebook page, we have people come on into this environment where we really want to cultivate this really clear abolitionist environment of where you're going to be learning about the abolitionist approach. Okay, I mean that's just what you're going to come into. It's a safe space for abolitionists to be, and it's also a place for anyone who wants to come and learn. And I'm happy to be part of that, and that's sort of what I really want to concentrate on. That's what I want to concentrate on in New Zealand, and that's what my vegan advocacy is all about. When I'm talking to non-vegans or vegans, it's about the abolition of exploitation, the abolitionist approach. Reading, if you want to know what that means, read the six principles. And so that's what I do. That's what I spend my time doing. So somebody came on the Abolitionist Approach Facebook page and talked about the United Poultry Concerns and how they're an abolitionist group. Well, if you're going to come to the abolitionist movement and tell people that you're an abolitionist group, get ready to have, some examination of your claim. Because it's not a light claim to make. And we're very protective, and rightly so, of the concept of abolition, just as we are and ought to be of the concept of veganism. And that's another thing I'll talk about, because that is just really going crazy with the vegan society, but we'll talk about that later. And just as it is about feminism, and I'm going to post another article that really reflects, like, because one of the things I've noticed, because this is the first time I've ever really been actively involved in any social justice movement, is the abolitionist vegan movement. I've never really been part of any, I usually don't like groups, it's just not my thing, but this I want to be part of, the abolitionist movement. And sorry, I lost my train of thought. But the feminist movement. I've always asked people. I was like, is it possible that in the feminist movement or in the civil rights movement there are actual racists, and in the feminist movement there's actual sexists? Because in the animal movement there's speciesists. And I was like, how does that happen? I was very naive about it. About the nature of human beings, I guess, because I was like, how can a movement that's supposed to be against exploitation be actual practitioners of the actual exploitation that they, and you know what, it does happen. I don't know a lot about, like I say, I'm white, so I'm not really part. I mean, I'd want to be an ally. I want to be part now. I want to be an informed participant. Well, I think that being in the abolitionist vegan movement, I am, but I'm becoming more informed about the aspects of like human rights, and I'm sure that it's the same for heterosexism and those kinds of things. I'm a straight person in terms of sexuality, so very run, not haven't experienced that either. But anyway, so sorry, I should probably stop talking, but I'm too bad. So Anyway, so the people say, oh, we're an abolitionist group, and then they get the spotlight put on them, because if you're going to say that, we're going to see if it's true. Because for one thing, I love the fact that there is another people who are doing abolition, but most of the time it's really not true. So they come onto the Gary Francione Facebook page and say, this is an abolitionist group. And so naturally we say, really, let's have a look. And we point out that due to certain, things that they're doing, they're not an abolitionist group. They're just not. And so when the they and then they get very upset. I mean, they come and they make this claim, and then they get the spotlight on them because we're like, okay, let's have a look. And then when we start saying, well, hang on a minute, then they get so incredibly angry, and it's like, well, don't claim something if, or they, well, they obviously believe that they are, this is the thing. But anyway, so we went on to, so Gary Francione went and had a look, and he knows a lot of these old time, sort of long time activists from back in the day. So one of the things that Gary Francione pointed out about United Poultry Concerns after they claim to be an abolitionist group is that they have this campaign that is about this, I think it's an Orthodox Jewish slaughter ceremony of chickens, and it's called Kaparos. I don't know if I'm pronouncing it right. It's spelled Kapparos, which is a campaign against this ritual. It's about what these Jewish people are doing to these chickens. So Gary Francione, very troubled by that, of course, as we all are, and said this is not the type of campaign that we should be doing. We should not be singling out this Jewish, Orthodox Jewish community for their use of chickens when we live in a society in which everybody uses chickens in equally horrific ways and for equally trivial measures. In fact, he said something, he said, hey, these people are doing it because they fervently think it's like some real has real religious consequences. They're not, they really, they're very religious people. So, most of the other people are just doing it because they taste good. So he's like, I mean, it's not justified, but it's like, come on, let's just promote veganism. And then they're like, we do promote veganism. And it's like, okay, but anybody can mention veganism or anybody can do that. But just these campaigns. So now that they have invited the spotlight onto themselves, now they're not liking it because it's being exposed. This is another, very troubling, prejudicial single issue campaign. So I'm going to just post some of the articles about it that Gary Francione has written. And he, of course, has been subject to really abusive personal, personal, being called names and just really not even focusing on the issue, but just calling him names. And that's just what always happens, is that's what's always happened ever since he started calling out these kind of campaigns, the sexist campaigns with PETA and all these kinds of things. They just, so the bottom line is, if you don't want to be exposed in your racist, xenophobic, or whatever single issue campaigns or welfarist campaigns, then don't come on the Gary Francione Facebook page and claim that you're an abolitionist group. So this campaign is just another. I mean, there's so many of them out there, but this is definitely one. And the amazing thing is, Gary Francione actually got invited to go and speak at a presentation about it, and the founder of the, or you know the you know the I the I don't know the direct the creator of the United Poultry Concerns group was there because this is their campaign. And so they both got to speak, and of course Gary Francione spoke about how if anybody in the room ought to be vegan if they care about this, and that it was, what the Jewish people were doing is no different than what everybody else is doing to all the other animals, and we should just concentrate on veganism as the moral baseline. And it was amazing. I think it was great that he got invited to speak there. So that's great. So anyway, this has been, so there's heaps of articles about this Kaparis campaign. If you want to read about the Kaparis campaign and the problems of it, I'll post this article from Gary Francione. But this has been going on all through June, and it's really, what's really sad is that it you know, people's egos get involved, and it really makes me sad. It really does. I just can't wait for the world to go vegan so I can just get off Facebook and turn off my computer and just read my books, and honestly. But another thing that's happened, which is really troubling, is the Vegan Society, which was founded by Donald Watson, has been taken over by some new CEOs. And it's really shocking how much they're compromising veganism. It's worse than it ever was before. It kind of began when, a while ago, when there was, Gary Francione was banned from posting on their Facebook group, I think, because we had a big discussion on there because they were accepting paid advertisements from non-vegan establishments and advertising for people to go there. And he took exception to that and said, well, aren't you a vegan society? I mean, why are you taking money and advertising this? They were, I think it was a vegetarian inn, and they had like goat's cheese and organic cow's milk and all this stuff on the menu. And goodness knows what else in the place. I mean, they might have had, you know, wool rugs or who knows. But and then you know, he was saying, you know, you're the vegan society. I mean, and then there was all this stuff. Well, now it's gotten even worse. And it's really, really depressing. Like, this is what I was talking about before. It's like defending the concept and defending what abolition means. Defending what, you know, the word vegan means, defending what feminism is. It's important, and we have to do it. And people can get really nasty, but that's the way it goes. But we have to just stick with it. And just remember when you... So I don't support the Vegan Society at all anymore. It's really sad what's happened. I'll post some links, but it's terrifying. And you know, I just have to share, I was in the supermarket last night, and I literally saw... on the magazine rack, I don't buy magazines, but I walked past the magazine rack and I looked down, and there was a picture of this beautiful young baby piglet and a sign saying, Happy Meat, the guide to buying meat or something. Literally, they used the phrase Happy Meat. If I had a smartphone, I would have taken a photo and posted it on Facebook. It was unbelievable. So they literally called it Happy Meat. It wasn't tongue-in-cheek. It wasn't sarcastic the way we do. This is industry. This is animal industry promoting, literally calling it Happy Meat. And there was, and I couldn't help myself. I just said, I can't remember what it was, like some healthy living featured article. It's like this magazine that they put out, and I think it's put out monthly, and it's like healthy living or something like that. And it's all about food and goodness knows what else, you know, organic, you know, I don't know, whatever. And yeah, Happy Meat. And then I turned it open, and there was the giant headings, Happy Meat, here's how to find your Happy Meat. And that's what they were literally calling it, Happy Meat. And they're talking about pigs, they're talking about pork, and this is all in New Zealand, talking about pork and talking about eggs and promoting. I just couldn't believe they actually called it Happy Meat. I just have never seen that phrase except for out of the mouths of abolitionists or other people who maybe not aren't abolitionists, but who at least, at the very least, recognize the welfare reform is useless and counterproductive. But yeah, to see the actual promotion of these products as Happy Meat by the actual people writing about it and endorsing it and saying, this is where you find your Happy Meat. This is the thing. And you know what's really interesting that I read? Free range is not, there is no legal guidelines for free range in New Zealand. So it basically can mean anything. Just so you know, there's no legal guideline. There's no actual official criteria for something to be called free range in New Zealand. And that was in this Happy Meat article, so they should know. So what's happening to the Vegan Society is terrifying, because it's really, but it's sort of typical. I mean, it's astonishing how pervasive this Happy Meat movement is. And the Vegan Society is really compromising veganism by they're basically saying that if you pr that they're that they're just saying, we're militant, and if because we insist on promoting veganism as a moral baseline, and that they're all about encouraging people to it's hard to explain. It's very slimy. It's very seductive. They're marketing people. These people are paid to do this. They're marketers. I believe that one of the people who worked there was she wasn't really vegan until she sort of started to get the job there. Her job is as a marketer. They're really about making money. They're getting paid salaries, and they want to. Oh, it's really sick. Words can't even describe what's happening. I'm not good at describing it. I'm going to post some links to the Facebook discussions. And there was also, I just saw on Gary Francione's Facebook page today that because they're marketers and because it's a business and or it's a charity, I guess, I'm sorry, is what it's called. The CEO has put out a statement, and in response, because the really good thing is, thanks to the abolitionist movement, there is tons of vegans out there who finally see through this, and they are outraged at their vegan society. They are like, "How can you do this? This is a complete betrayal of veganism. This is a complete betrayal of the non-human animals. What has happened to the vegan society? It used to be, back when it started, it used to be abolitionist, really." And so they're alarmed now. Because this is what's really good. Like, this is the positive thing to get out of all this. One of the positive things to get out of all this is, first of all, when it comes to the Kaparis campaign, there's been heaps of people who really realize that it's wrong, and they understand why. And that's because they've been learning about abolition, and they've been reading about abolition. They've been going to Gary Francione's Facebook page and reading his articles, and I'm hoping that people read his books and watching his videos. He's always doing interviews and presentations and things, and it's never had to change or evolve, because it's never going to, because it's always the same thing. Exploitation is wrong, animal use is wrong. I mean, it's consistent. So that's the beautiful thing about it. And so there are more and more people who get it, and on the Vegan Society Facebook page is all these people. Like, I have to tell you, when I first started, and we would go and say this, the Vegan Society had done something, it would always be like, I knew everybody who was commenting against it. Like, I knew all the abolitionists by name, and I like used to email with them. I've lost touch with a lot because a lot of stuff's happened, but I knew them all. Every single person, because there was like 10 of us, you know what I mean? It seemed, And now there's just people I've never heard of. I don't have a clue who they are. And they totally get it. And they're like, "What? This is outrageous. This is a betrayal of the concept of veganism. We need to focus on veganism as the moral baseline." And these are people who are saying, "You." And then the vegan society is like, "Well, shouting and screaming at people doesn't work." And these people come right back and say, "You don't have a clue what you're talking about. Abolitionist vegan advocacy is not about shouting and screaming. You don't even know. Learn what it's about. It's about it's and they totally bust apart the straw men that these people that these it was just so great. And like, there's heaps of people, and I'm tons of people compared to before. And like I say, I do live in this very small world of online activism. And it's quite fun. I just really want to be in this place where I want people to come to our space and learn, and I want to be part of the educators in that space. When I go out into the streets, it's a really positive experience. I've told everybody that it's changed over the last few years, and I still do the same. I still advocate the same thing, but so that's what I do. But it is getting out there, because that's true. Like, honestly, 4 years ago, whenever it was, I knew every single person who was commenting in favor of abolition by name, and I knew them. Like, I'd been in touch with them personally, because we were so small. And now it's just so many more people who get it, and yeah, it's really positive, actually. So that's the good thing about all this. So go on the Facebook page, and you'll see a lot of people, unless they've deleted the comments or something. Who knows what they've done? But I'll post the link anyway. And I'll post you so let me just read a little bit. So this is the statement on the Vegan Society's website from the CEO. I mean, I can't believe there's even a CEO. I mean, that just, I, ugh. Anyway, we have been listening to your concerns and would like to address a few quick points. So who are the Facebook admins? There's a comment about that because people have been complaining about the responses. They make an apology about how, because the Vegan Society is telling people they don't have to be vegan because they just have this campaign, and then they're saying, no, it's being taken out of context. You know, we just want to make it accessible to everyone. And anyway, and why are people saying that the Vegan Society has sold out? I mean, this is the kind of questions that they're scrambling to answer. And I mean, this is they're a marketing campaign, so they are addressing this, you know, on their website. But they're basically apologizing, and they're basically so they're talking about money, and we need the funds. So basically she says, we are here to support vegans. This is part of our mission, but we won't be able to provide the support if we can't raise the funds to sustain our charity in the long term. So we need to sell more products with the vegan trademark. The vegan market share is growing, and it funds our work. So in other words, my salary depends on it. All right. So yeah, it's been an interesting and tumultuous month as usual, I guess you could say. For myself, it's been wonderful. I've feel like I'm connecting with things a bit better, and I'm one of the things I'm really sad is I haven't done my street stall for the y longest. The weather has been absolutely atrocious. It's raining so unpredictably all the time. There's nothing worse than going out there and getting all set up and then getting poured on, and then the rain stops, and then you're like, oh, should we stay? And then it pours, and then you go home, and then it stays sunny, and you just feel so angry. So it's been, I haven't had a chance to do it. Also, I've been really busy doing some things on the weekend with work, but it's winter, and you know, I've my website's pretty much up to date, so that's pretty cool. And I'm just, yeah, doing my podcast. Eat Like You Care has come out in Spanish, just so you know. I announced it on my Spanish podcast and on my Spanish YouTube channel. I don't think I can do my YouTube channels anymore because something's changed, and the videos, I record the videos from some internal, just my video camera, like my computer, you know, camera. And I don't have like any conversion software, and I guess I could try to. I don't really know what, I just don't know enough about video. So when I upload it to YouTube, it's out of sync. And I mean, that's so annoying. Nobody's going to watch that. It's so annoying watching a video that's out of sync. And I have no idea how to fix it. So not going to do that anymore. Anyway, that's okay because I've done some other stuff. I mean, at least I put the six principles on there, and I announced that Eat Like You Care is available in Spanish. So that's really important. So anyway, I hope you enjoyed listening to this and that you at least hopefully learned something. I can't, yeah, I talked about the how things have been going in terms of my advocacy at work. Oh, I have a little funny story to finish with. Not really funny, but because I've moved to this other department, I'm on a different floor, and my cubicle where I used to sit, where I'm going back to, I don't know if I'm actually going to go back to the same cubicle because we have staff change arounds and things move around. So I think I probably won't have the same cubicle, but I had all of those abolitionist approach posters plastered on my cubicle walls. And I plastered them, and I had the really strong statements, like the morally repugnant ones and all this stuff. And I just assumed, I saw the emails going around about how everybody was moving to, you know, we were changing around and some people were going to sit here, and sometimes we have to desk share. So because I work at a 24-hour, that is a 24-hour, 7-day-a-week call center where I work. So you can sometimes desk chair. So I'll work until 4:30, and then somebody might be working there from 5 till 10, and then somebody else might be working from, you know, 10 till 6 in the morning. So you might have three different people using that same computer. So you know, you have to adjust the desk height, and because it's all orthopedic, like if you're sitting there typing, you know, intensive data entry, you could cripple yourself if your desk isn't set up right. So it's kind of annoying having to desk share, but that's the nature of the game. But one of the things I just assumed that my posters would be covered over or taken down because I took up every inch of wall space on there because I didn't have to desk share when I was there. There was nobody else sitting at my desk. I was one of the lucky ones and it was just my desk. So the computer was, you know, the keyboard was always in the right place and the desk height and my chair height had been done by the orthopedic, you know, consultant and it was always perfect. And my posters could stay there because if you're desk sharing, they might want to put up pictures of their family. So you kind of have to share the wall space with them. But it turns out, so I assumed that somebody else would be sitting there now because I've been gone since March and that all my posters would be taken down or covered over. And I was like, that's all right. I'll just print more out and put more up when I go back. But then one of the women who works up there saw me and she said, oh, hey, you know, so-and-so's sitting at your desk and she's becoming uncomfortable and is finding it really hard to, I think she said, eat meat, which is annoying because my posters are all about veganism and dairy and just all animal use. But apparently this woman is being affected by these posters and it's making her think about her consumption. And I thought that was great. I was like, really? That's fantastic. I said, are they still there? I can't believe that those posters are still there. And she said, oh yeah, they're still there. And I was like, awesome. You know, good. Good. So hopefully this woman's going to go vegan. I did put a copy of Eat Like You Care in the work bookshelf. So I'm really hoping people read it. So anyway, I just thought I'd share that my posters are still there and there's someone who sits there and even though she's completely unbelievably busy, like you just have no idea how busy we are in that place, she's still getting a chance to read them and look at them and they are making her think. So that's, you know, that's the least you can hope for anyway. So put up posters at your work if you can in your little cubicle and just, they're comforting to me. I put them up for me because they say all the things that I'm thinking all the time. And it's comforting for me to have them there, to be those voices, even if they're silent and they're only visual. They're not silent. They're just visual. They're not, you know, it's comforting because you're surrounded by people talking about animal use, people engaging in animal use, people eating flesh right around you. And you just want to scream. You know, but screaming's not a good idea. So if you have your posters, they can. And another thing, like if people forget or if people are new and they come over and say, would you like a piece of cake? You can just point to one of the posters. You can just be like, no, point. And you can point to the one that talks about, you know, how dairy products, you harm a mother every time you use a glass of milk or whatever. And there you go. That's the answer. The answer is no, I'm not eating your piece of cake. And that's the reason why. And it's a picture of beautiful cow and her calf. That's one of the posters. So you can just use them and point to them. So anyway, thank you so much for listening. If you've managed to get through this whole podcast and yeah, please, please get out there and do vegan activism in your community. It's so important. It can be done. Please consider doing it. We are changing things. Things are happening. You better believe it. All right. Thank you for listening and I'll be back. Bye.